You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, summer's a great season for giving, getting involved, and volunteering, including lots of walkathons and other seasonal events. An expert on philanthropy gives us some advice on helping our communities in the summer months. Now, scientists say there's a 66% chance that global temperatures will increase by 1.5 degrees Celsius in the coming half decade, three times the chance predicted just a few years ago in 2020. If it happens, that'll be the first time that 1.5 degrees Celsius threshold is broken. That's been seen as a target to avoid in international climate negotiations. Sustaining those temperatures could raise the risk of dangerous weather events, including heat waves, rising sea levels, and wildfires. You could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about how increasing temperatures could affect you? Have you been impacted by climate change? What, if any, actions do you want to see taken to prevent further warming? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Daniel Vimont is a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences and former director of the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research at UW-Madison. Dan, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks. It's good to be here.
I want to talk about that 1.5 degree number relative to what? I want to situate that as we start.
Yeah, that's good. So first of all, that the number that was reported in that in the WMO, the World Meteorological Organization document, that's relative to the global mean temperature, sort of a pre-industrial, so 1850 to 1900 average. So that's kind of a time period that represents a time when before a lot of global warming or human-induced global warming started drastically affecting our global temperature record. And that's a little different than what we typically use. We typically talk about the 1900 to the 20th century average.
When we look at what global temperatures have been over the last bunch of decades, in general, right, they've been higher than that benchmark, that late 1800s benchmark, in and inching upward over time. Is that about the right trend?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they've been way above that benchmark. In fact, the warmest year in the 20th century was 1998, and that was a year after a big El Nino event. That year was, I think it was about 0.8 or 0.6 of a degree warmer than the average over that over the 20th century. In 2012, we left that behind. We'll never be that cold again. So we're definitely well above the average temperature for the 20th century.
You mentioned El Nino, and that's part of the story here of why there's this prediction we'll hit this 1.5 degree number sooner rather than later. We've been in the other thing, La Nina weather patterns. Can you talk about those patterns and why they affect that overall global temperature?
Yeah, so El Nino is a phenomenon that occurs in the tropical Pacific, and it may seem like that's very distant from Wisconsin. But keep in mind that the tropical Pacific is the largest ocean basin on Earth, and it affects an area that's just enormous. So the Pacific covers an enormous part of our Earth. So when an El Nino occurs, there's warming in the equatorial region of the sea surface temperatures across the entire Pacific. It's a complete reorganization of the heat content in the tropical Pacific. It's the biggest thing naturally that can happen on year-to-year timescales to our climate system. When we see these El Nino events, we tend to see global mean temperatures that spike after an El Nino event. So 1998 was the warmest year in the 20th century, and that was a year after the big 1997-98 El Nino event. 2016 is the current record global temperature, and that was the year after the 2015-2016 El Nino event. And so what they're pointing to with this expectation that we'll exceed the 1.5 degrees Celsius mark is the idea that we're likely to have another big El Nino event sometime in the next few years. Put that on top of the gradually warming temperatures, and the chance of exceeding 1.5 degrees Celsius is pretty high.
Now, people might hear 1.5 degrees. You know, if the room I'm in goes up 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit or Celsius, I probably won't notice it. Why is this a big deal globally, though?
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons. One, that 1.5 degree benchmark has been something that was set during the Paris Accord, I believe. That was a benchmark that is a number we don't want to exceed. The number of sort of bad impacts just continues to increase the more warming we experience. To put that in perspective, coming inside from a cold day into a warm, warm house is a lot more than 1.5 degrees Celsius. But if we look in the historical time period, 1.5 degrees Celsius is actually a large warming, and it's happening very quickly. So since the last ice age, we've warmed by maybe 4 to 6 degrees Celsius, and that's occurred over, 14,000 years, but we're seeing this warming occurring over a matter of decades, and that's much too fast for systems to adjust to it. And so that's what the rate of the warming is something that is certainly is one of the reasons why that number takes on sort of a new significance.
Talking to Daniel Vimont, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. Looking at the latest worries, latest predictions about climate change and the impact it could have on us, you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So this doesn't take into consideration any of the feedback loops, such as like what's burning currently in Canada. And I guess my question is two-part. One, what are they planning, how are they going to start taking some of the stuff into consideration? And number two, by having an oil company executive from the UAE run this thing, isn't that kind of the equivalent of having like Michael Corleone or Al Capone run a commission on crime to try and lower crime rates?
UAE running which organization, Marcus?
No, they have an oil executive that is going to be chairing this upcoming COBCOM in the United Arab Emirates.
Gotcha. Marcus, thanks a lot for the call. First of all, Dan, his thoughts on feedback loops. I hear things like, maybe methane thawing in tundra-type regions. Is there a concern that if we hit some threshold, things could spiral even faster?
Certainly. A lot of these feedbacks are taken into account. So, our climate models and our analyses do take into account feedbacks with, some biological cycles. So ocean biogeochemistry, certainly things like water vapor feedbacks and so forth. So when you talk about feedbacks in general, a lot of that is accounted for in the models that we use to project climate change. In the next couple of years, we're still going to be dominated by the anthropogenic signal. As we continue to warm, these are issues. So you're raising a really good point here. We need to understand fluxes from the land surface, especially in polar regions. As polar regions start to thaw out or continue to thaw out, polar regions have been accelerating quite a bit. And these are things that that we need to better understand. I would say that, we're certainly not ignoring these, but the uncertainties of those are large.
Let's start to get into some of the impacts now. We can't always say this change in climate is going to produce this change in weather in this part of the world, but what kind of things does it put it at more of a risk of?
Yeah, so with more warming, so around here in Wisconsin, we'll see a lot more extreme warm days and nights. I mean, that's sort of an obvious one. And again, we talk about an individual day or weather events as having these large fluctuations. But when you exceed certain values, there's various impacts. For example, hot days, heat is a big impact for public health. And hot nights are even more of an impact for public health. We've seen in Wisconsin trends in nighttime temperatures, with warming nighttime temperatures exceeding the warming daytime temperatures. And so if you can't sleep at night, it exacerbates all kinds of health issues. And so we expect to see more issues associated with heat stress and human health there. Changes to ecosystems, warming temperatures affect lakes in different ways. It can increase, for example, stratification, meaning how the amount of, which affects mixing, like in the Great Lakes. So we might see more harmful algal blooms in our Great Lakes, more sort of anoxic conditions. Everything from that to changes in wildlife, wildlife migrations, changes in habitat, reductions in snowfall and snow, the characteristics of the snow season here in Wisconsin, which will impact tourism and so forth. So the impacts are really varied, and they're all over the place. And then certainly globally, we see impacts to reducing biodiversity, extinction of various species, loss of coral reefs, just all sorts of impacts.
We're talking to Dan Vimont, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences and former director of the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research at UW-Madison, looking at an international prediction of average global temperatures crossing this 1.5 degree increase threshold over the next few years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about some of the science behind climate change, about the impact it could have? Have you experienced those impacts yourself? What steps do you want to see taken to try to slow things down? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about climate change and what a 1.5 degree increase, so this relative to the late 1800s, would mean. Dan Vimont stays with us, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences and former director of the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research at UW-Madison. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now with Brian in Madison. Brian, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, climate change has been one of the most important issues to me my entire life, and things are just consistently getting worse, and it really doesn't seem like our larger government systems, economic models care. So I just wanted to ask the guests, what do you do to avoid climate despair?
That's a really good question.
Yeah. Thanks, Brian. Go ahead, Dan. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, so first of all, thanks for what you're doing. And actually, I know there's a lot of listeners out there who are trying to do their part in reducing their impact, their footprint. And that's great. You're doing great work. So that's one thing to remember. When you study this every day, there's always this kind of two-sided response to it. It's kind of like when you see for me as a climate scientist or as someone who studies fluid dynamics, you see a hurricane developing and you think to yourself, wow, that's this amazing looking hurricane. And then you look at the track, you see that it's going to come right across Puerto Rico, or that you see that it's going to come right across Grenada, and it hits you in a real serious way. So to me, I have a little bit of a different relationship with it, in that I love thinking about the math and the science and the physics of the climate system. And every time I learn something new, I get excited about it. At the same time, I look at what's going on, and you're right. We're not, the amount of action that is needed and the scale of what needs to happen in order to reduce this is way beyond what we are dealing with at this point. And so we do need massive coordinated efforts to try and reduce climate change. The good news is that, all of us are impacted in different ways, but all of us can do something. All of us can, there's no one solution to this. There's hundreds of solutions, and it's not like hundreds, any one of those would work. All of them are needed. And so anything you're doing is going to help. If you can, next time you get a car, think about switching to a electric vehicle. If you're not already If you're not already getting your electricity from renewable sources, sign up for those programs. MG&E is committed to going carbon neutral or zero emissions in the next, I think, couple of decades, which is, you know, which is good as well. So think about the things you can do, especially one-time things you can do. You know, are you gonna, if you're buying a new, if you're moving somewhere, can you move near your work where you can bike all the time? Not only does it reduce your carbon emissions, but it also, being on your bike is fun. It's good for your health. It's good to get out. You see other people. It's good for your social health. It's good for, you know, there's all kinds of these co-benefits to doing something about this. So now I'm dragging on here, but I also want to address this point that you said that our economies are not acting fast enough. Now, I want to get away from this idea that I want us to get away as a society from this idea that it's going to cost us a lot and that will be painful. Let's think about opportunities. Every dollar we spend on fossil fuel in Wisconsin is a dollar we send out of this state because we don't harvest any fossil fuels in Wisconsin. Instead of that, if we are developing renewable technologies, if we embrace this, then you know that's a benefit for our manufacturing economy here in Wisconsin. It brings jobs, it improves health, it improves quality of life. There's all kinds of opportunities we have to try and reduce the amount of climate change that we'll experience, and we need to be talking about that.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. I'm not sure if this is a story you've been following, Dan, but our caller earlier mentioned, and a couple other callers have raised it. The COP28 conference coming up. The president is, in fact, someone who runs an oil company, the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company. Concerns about having fossil fuel people at the head of a climate change conference. Is that something you're watching at all, or are you focusing on the science more?
I have to admit, I am focusing more on the science. And the one thing I will say is that as scientists, I don't think we're going to be swayed by anybody who's running a conference. So the science will continue, and we've seen that through attacks on climate science over the last 40 years 50 years, that despite the political scene, we know a lot more about climate change, and even though the basic science has been known for since the mid-1800s, late 1800s, Eunice Foote, a woman who looked at the impact of carbon dioxide on temperatures back in the 1800s to present. We've known the science for a while, but we continue to progress. We continue to improve our knowledge. What we need is action in the political scene.
Let's go back to our callers now. Peter is with us in Racine. Peter, hello.
Hello, thanks. Nobody seems to be talking about geothermal. That's how a nuclear power plant works. They heat up the water, and then they run a turbine. You can get hot water just going down into the ground. You don't have to go all the way down to the magma, the lava, like a volcano. There should be special roads for lightweight vehicles. I think there's one in Milwaukee that's special just for bicycles.
Peter, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Peter, bringing up a geothermal energy, Dan, as part of the energy sources we could use there. How big a difference, whether it's geothermal or other sources, would going to non-fossil fuel sources make to our carbon emissions and to hitting that 1.5 degrees Celsius target we've been talking about?
That's a great question. So geothermal is certainly part of a solution there. When we look at, I encourage people to check out Project Drawdown. And so the data I'm talking about here comes from that. Currently about a third of the sources of carbon dioxide comes from the electricity generation sector. So shifting that completely over to wind turbines and utility scale solar, or distributed solar would is one way to is probably the most effective way of reducing the amount of carbon emissions that comes from, say, coal plants or methane power plants. Efficiency gets us a little bit. Improving efficiency gets us a little bit, but probably about a third of our emissions could be addressed in that way. But that's only a third. You know, we have a tremendous amount of opportunity in the food and agriculture sector, especially addressing food waste. If you're eating a, you know, think about switching towards plant-based diets. We've been, here at home, my wife is a fantastic cook, by the way, has started cooking a lot more vegan meals, and they're delicious. I mean, especially around here, you've got all these this great produce in Wisconsin. Get down to your farmer's market, buy local, take a look at some of the wonderful things they've got, and start experimenting with some fun new ways of eating. So removing meat from your meat-based, you don't have to completely remove. Eventually, we'll see some big changes, but just give it a try. Start along that path and see where it takes you. There's a lot of other options there as well, from industry to improving building efficiency and thinking about how we use buildings, and then the transportation sector as well. So there's a lot, that geothermal is maybe a great solution in some places. And as I said, there's hundreds of solutions. There isn't one of them that will do the job, but all of them are needed. So if you're thinking geothermal, if that's something that works for you, go for it. You know, if you're thinking of trying to change your diet, go for it. Give it a shot. Start trying these things. Look at Project Drawdown, and that's how we'll change.
Dan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
That's Dan Vimont, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences, former director of the Nelson Institute Center for Climatic Research at UW-Madison. He talked to us about some of the latest research showing we may soon hit a climate threshold we don't want to hit in the next few years. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, find out about the unique mental health needs of seniors and an aging population, what kind of resources are out there, and join in with your experiences and your questions. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, meet a renowned master carpenter, author of the new book, Building: A Carpenter's Notes on Life and the Art of Good Work. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, if you want to get involved in your community or raise money for a cause, summer offers some unique opportunities. There are tons of walk-a-thons or bike, run, etc.-a-thons that bring communities together for causes at the national or the local level. Our next guest says those are great opportunities to get involved and has some other advice for summertime giving as well. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you participate in one of these, maybe an annual walk-a-thon or other community fundraising event? We want to hear about it. Did you help organize one or do a walk in the name of someone else? Do you find other ways to get involved, do charity work, or maybe volunteer in the summer? If you're with an organization that needs some volunteers, tell us about it. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Lisa Dietlin is a keynote speaker, author, and founder of the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy. Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me. I love talking about giving in the summer.
Now, it seems like there are these local and national walks and bikes and run-a-thons all over the place. How did this get to be such a big thing?
Well, it's a great question, and you're absolutely on point. It seems like any weekend or even weekday, you could participate in a walk-a-thon, a bike-a-thon, a marathon, anything that has a thon with it. It actually started in the early 1970s with the March of Dimes, the Walk for Life, the Relay Walk for Life. They were the first nonprofit organization to do that. And now we have them with almost every major national organization. Think about, the Walk to End Alzheimer's. Many of the local chapters do walks in their communities in the hopes of finding a cure, raising dollars for the research to find a cure for Alzheimer's, but breast cancer, Susan G. Komen, a lot of walks in the end of the summer and even into October, you know, which is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, thinking about how can we walk and raise money so that some of these diseases and illnesses that afflict us can be mitigated, if not eradicated from, you know, our world.
Now, we could just, you know, write a check to the relevant organization, but you, Lisa, see some value in getting together people together in these walkathon type events. What is that?
Well, you know, the first value is, you know, you actually come together in community, and coming out of what we just went through, the pandemic, and now we're in an endemic. I mean, I think all of us value community so much, Rob. We want to be with others. So the first is to realize that you would be in community. It's great thing to do for your health. Many of my friends that participate in the Chicago Marathon, you know, also do it for their health. But whether they're doing a walkathon or a bikeathon, they're feeling better about themselves. And most of them get this, grab a friend or two. It might be mom, it might be dad, it might be a family event, especially if a disease affects a family. You might see sisters walking together if mom died of breast cancer, or you might see the entire family biking together if there was a preemie baby born or somebody has MS. I mean, people come together. So it's a great opportunity to celebrate not only your community in which you live, but to celebrate those girlfriends, those guy friends, those families, those sisters, those brothers, that sometimes we get so busy, we don't have that opportunity to get together. And this is get together with those that you love and do a really good thing.
Our producer, Tim Peterson, is actually doing a walk this weekend to raise money for a heart attack research, a SCAD heart attack, that's S-C-A-D. And the event is called a SCADaddle, which is, I think, a pretty clever way to do it. A lot of these groups, local and national, have actually kind of had some fun pulling these things together and getting people involved, it seems like, Lisa.
They certainly have. I did. I was working with an organization, the Foundation for Sarcoidosis Research. And sarcoidosis is a disease of where your organ becomes inflamed and enlarged, and it can be any organ in your body. So it's not well known, but it definitely afflicts a lot of individuals. And they did a superhero theme where everybody dresses up as a superhero. Like, you know, we're going to beat this. We're superheroes. We're living with this disease. So you're absolutely right. And, you know, I love when I see moms and dads and aunts and uncles bringing the young children, that next generation. Rob, you and I've talked about how important it is that we teach that next generation how to give. And what better way than to get outside, get in nature, whether you're walking, biking, or running, and make it a family affair.
Lisa Dietland is with us, giving expert. We're talking about great ways to give back to our communities in the summertime. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you participate regularly in a walkathon or bikeathon or you name it? What brought you out there to do it? Do you get together with family to do it or bring kids along? Are there special Father's Day philanthropy type things you like to do? Are you volunteering this summer or do you need volunteers? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lisa, Father's Day just around the corner on Sunday. I'm a dad. Father's Day gifts, not notoriously, you know, awesome. You suggest finding ways to say, hey, what does dad care about? Let's do something along those lines.
I certainly do. You know, I think our dads are the unsung heroes of philanthropy and making charitable donations and volunteering. Think about it. Our dads usually are our first little league coaches or soccer coaches. And we certainly have a lot of dads and uncles and grandpas who, you know, get involved with Boy Scouts or Cub Scouts and what have you. And we never think about our dads in terms of philanthropy. My research shows that everybody thinks mom taught them about philanthropy, but you know, we have some pretty famous people that have done amazing things, some male figures in the philanthropic realm. So I think why not celebrate dad by doing something philanthropic? Perhaps you find a walk or a run or an opportunity to bicycle together. You know, what our parents want more than anything is to spend time with us. And how about spending time with dad and doing good for charity and maybe a cause that dad cares about? Probably your dad doesn't need another pair of slippers or another tie. I mean, we're kind of a lot of us working remote and not going back to the office, But one thing you can give your dad that is so precious is your time, and then doubling down by saying, Dad, what cause do you care about? Let's go do that together.
It's Brianna. Call her now at 800-642-1234. Robin is with us in Milwaukee. Robin, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Oh, I heard you mention the Susan G. Komen walk, and I work on that walk. I thought I'd call in and invite everybody to come on down.
Where do you do in Milwaukee? You help organize that?
Yes, yes. The Milwaukee walk is this year. It doesn't take place till the end of September, but registration is open all summer long. It's September 24th, and we host it on the Summerfest grounds now. And we walk out around Lakeshore State Park in the morning on Sunday, this 24th of September.
I got to ask, Robin, right, since you organize it, do you actually get to do the walk yourself? Or are you too busy organizing?
I've worked on it for 14 years, and I've never once done the walk.
Oh, no.
That's okay. I have a question for Robin. Robin,
sure.
Do you folks have a requirement for fundraising? Because a lot of times people get scared they might not be able to raise the money. Do you have a requirement, or do you have suggestions for your walkers?
No, we used to have a registration fee when we were the Race for the Cure. When we changed to the More Than Pink Walk, and our organization is all about breaking down barriers for people to access care. And I like that we now have no barriers to access the walk, too. So registration is free. And then we talk to people about fundraising. So if they're interested in supporting local breast cancer patients, or helping provide mammograms and tests for people, or supporting breast cancer research, we fund all of that through their donations, but there's no requirement. If they raise $100, they earn an event t-shirt. Everybody gets a nifty little Komen wrap when they get there free, but fundraisers earn the shirt, but it's no registration cost, so you can come with your whole family, and it's not like you have to pay $25 for each person. It's really accessible. It's a really powerful, very fun, very emotional day.
Fantastic. That's Robin, great. Thanks for sharing that and the work you're doing there. Lisa, do you see groups making that kind of approach, saying, hey, we don't want to have a barrier to people participating in this event?
Absolutely. I'm so glad that Robin shared that. You know, the thing that keeps people wary is the idea of a registration fee and or an amount that they have to raise. They feel like they have to raise. And you know, Rob, I'm a fundraiser. I'm not scared to ask anybody because, well, I'm not afraid of the no. I think about, what about the yes? They might say yes, you know. I'll ask anybody for anything. But a lot of people aren't wired that way, and there is some hesitation. So getting them involved, awareness is so important. And again, you're building community. All those walkers that Robin is supporting by in the 14 years that she's talking to and registering and smiling and showing up on that day, their lives are being changed, and they're all sharing their stories of, you know, survivorship and what happened in their families and this disease and how important it is for us all to come together and be aware in community. And, you know, once you get there, you know, if you're like me, you're going to be writing a check or making a donation or having it in the back of your mind, the way that you can take care of yourself so that you lessen the risk. You know, research shows, I was just reading some research about walking, that a recent research out of Harvard, it reduces breast cancer by 14%, women who walk more than 3 times a week.
Thanks a lot for that call, Robin. We're talking to Lisa Dietland, expert on giving and volunteering. We're getting advice on great ways to make a difference in the summer months. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you go out in a walkathon yourself, a local one, a national one? Tell us about it. What kind of volunteering are you doing this summer? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Lisa Dietland from the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy. She's here with advice on giving and volunteering and making a difference in our communities with the summer months in mind. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Are you getting ready to do some kind of a fundraising walk coming up, say, or do you have special summertime volunteering things that you like to do? Are you with an organization and you're looking for people to get involved in your event? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Lisa, when it comes to hunger relief, I think it's on our minds a lot around Thanksgiving and through the December holidays, through Christmas. But in a note, you mentioned summer is actually a really important time to think about food relief. What's going on?
It really is, and especially for our children. You know, many of our children have food accessible to them when they're in school. Think about the free and reduced lunch programs and breakfast programs. And there are even schools that everybody in the school, because of the poverty level in that community, have access to free breakfast and lunch. And then when school's out, these kids become part of the food insecure numbers that we count, meaning they don't know where their next meal is going to come from. And studies have been done that show that oftentimes a child that is misbehaving or having difficulties is a hungry child. So I always recommend that you think about giving a few extra dollars to your local food bank, your food pantry, the soup kitchen, whatever is going on in your community, or contact your local school and ask what they're doing. A lot of schools are stepping up and having summer feeding programs. There might be a reading program or other activities, and then they also feed the children. You know, we just can't think about hunger those last 2 months of the year. Hunger exists 365 days a year, 24/7 for a lot of individuals, and especially children. You know, they say there are 9 million children any year that need access to food. And every community, anybody who's listening to this, whether they're in the urban areas of Milwaukee and Madison or the rural areas up in, you know, the upper part of Sheboygan and the Dells of Wisconsin, they need access to food, those children. And I recommend giving cash. Rob, you know, you and I've talked about this. Well, we oftentimes want to clean out our pantry. What you don't want to eat in your pantry, somebody who's hungry most likely won't want to eat it or don't know what to do with it. So cash is king. And food banks have 4 to 6 times the buying power. So meaning if you were to go to the store and buy $10 worth of groceries, because of the relationships food bank has, if you give $10, they can buy $40 of food.
And a point you've made in the past, Lisa, is you love people giving and helping out. You also think there's room for advocating. Maybe it's for a policy or a local program like that summer feeding thing to maybe take a step even beyond direct giving.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so glad you asked that, Rob. Absolutely. You know, if you are at all interested in solving any of these issues that we've been talking about, whether it's a disease or it's about school-aged children being hungry in the summer, you know, and you know somebody who sits on a city council, a county commission, is a legislator, don't be afraid to have the conversation. You don't have to have all the facts and figures. Start the conversation and share. You could say, hey, I was listening to Central Time and I heard that hunger is an issue for kids when they're out of school. What are we doing about it in our community? You might be that one person who's aware of it that makes a difference in your community. Perhaps nobody's thinking about it because you know, I grew up in northern Michigan. I know what northern Wisconsin like. You got the beautiful lake. Everybody wants to go up north, you know, with the cottages and the cabins and to the lake. But for a lot of kids, food being available in their homes is a 24/7 issue they're facing. And maybe you're that person in the community who happens to know your best friend from high school is on the city council, and you pick up the phone, you have a cup of coffee, and you start talking about the issue.
And speaking of school, I don't want to freak out anybody just enjoying the early days of summer vacation. School will return eventually, there's a lot of room for helping people with that back-to-school supply season and to start thinking ahead on that.
There really is. You know, one of my favorite I'm a saver and a shopper and a couponer, and I'm always like, buy one get one free, and you know, like, oh my gosh, what do I have to do with all this extra stuff? And you know, when we're putting together our kids' school backpack, how about making an extra one for the child at school that doesn't have the resources at home to have everything on that list? When my nieces and nephews, who are now in their 20s, were younger, you know, they would bring home, or they would be sent home with them, the list for the supplies they needed for that next year. And, you know, we all made it an effort that we combined resources, or give me that list. I'll fill a backpack that you can take to the school and put in the office, that some child that doesn't have those resources at home. And we learned about that during COVID, when people were losing their jobs and becoming ill and losing their lives. Like, we got to help each other. We're all in this community. So It's never too early to start thinking about, you know, whatever you're putting in your kid's backpack. Do you have a little bit extra, especially if there's those buy one, get one free, or buy two, get one free? Create that backpack, and just so the school has it. And a lot of schools, Rob, I'll go back to the food issue. They have food pantries, and they have, there's the backpack program that Feeding America runs, where kids that they've identified that don't have food in the home, the school will put food in a backpack, kid-friendly food that the child doesn't need to use the stove or doesn't need to use a microwave. You know, you think about peanut butter, you think about tuna fish or beef.
And we'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Lisa Dietlin for joining us again, founder of the Institute of Transformational Philanthropy. Now, a bill passed in the state legislature this week aims to make it harder for residents to block new housing projects. As Joe Schultz reports, one barrier municipal leaders face in addressing a housing shortage is their own constituents.
If you want to hear controversy at a local government meeting, stop by in a night when they're considering a proposal to build some new apartments. Meetings about developments or zoning changes in Neenah, Oshkosh, and Madison within the last year sounded like this.
It is also likely that he's going to put recovering drug addicts into this community.
That will bring significant increase in traffic and noise.
It will lower the quality of life for people who are already there.
And at a recent meeting in Oshkosh, one phrase came up over and over.
Neighborhood character.
Neighborhood character.
Neighborhood character.
Neighborhood character.
But Wisconsinites need more places to live. The state needs to build at least 140,000 housing units by the end of the decade just to keep pace with current demand. That's according to the Wisconsin Counties Association. Madison renter Ian Jameson says the shortage makes finding a place to live feel like a high-stakes game of musical chairs.
There are not enough chairs, or in this case, houses to go around, so it gets more and more complicated and competitive.
And a recent report from the city of Green Bay says the shortage has disproportionately affected marginalized groups and low-income individuals. Robin Scott is with the African American Resource Center in Green Bay. She spoke to the city council about the issue earlier this year.
We serve so many clients every day at our agency, from domestic violence to sexual assault to youth programming. And the number one disparity that exists right now in our community is sadly housing.
Renter Willa Hovich created a group in Madison to advocate for more housing because he was frustrated with conversations locally.
It seemed like people were a lot of times just throwing anything at the wall, trying to block changes to their neighborhood.
He says public comments at local government meetings are often skewed towards homeowners, not the people who could benefit from new projects.
A lot of people who are going to live in new housing don't know that they're going to live into it until it's done. So they don't have as much motivation to show up to a meeting for a place that they might live in.
Legislation passed this week could even the playing field for some multifamily housing projects. Under the proposal, communities couldn't veto projects that met existing zoning rules. Republican State Senator Romaine Quinn co-sponsored the legislation. He recently spoke to WPR's Central Time about the bill.
Communities would no longer be allowed to move the ball on developers when a project is trying to come in.
That's what happened earlier this year when a developer abandoned an apartment project in a Milwaukee suburb that met the city's zoning code, but drew strong opposition from neighbors. Jerry DeShane is with the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. He recommends local officials have open conversations with constituents when projects become controversial.
We need more housing units virtually everywhere in Wisconsin. We need to start talking to our citizens about that so that we show people that it's not that scary.
Chris Hayes is with the city of Neenah. He's seen similar fear of change derail multifamily housing developments. He says a recent proposal to turn a former middle school into apartments generated familiar concerns.
Crime is going to go up, traffic is going to become ridiculous, and surrounding property values are going to go down.
But he says that's generally not what happens. He's looked at past multifamily projects to evaluate crime, traffic, and neighborhood property values.
The insinuation that somehow things are going to get worse in each one of those categories hasn't proven to be true.
The housing shortage has become such a universal issue in Wisconsin that it's forcing lawmakers and communities to move past a fear of change. They hope that makes it easier to build homes. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the Biden administration has a new point person on censorship as some states make it easier to remove books from schools and libraries and others make it harder. Look at the latest news on book bans around the country. And on Food Friday, get advice on choosing the right skillet for the right job. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.